Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom and the American way. And bailouts? No. I've been giving this some serious thought. And if I were in Congress right now, and, you know, probably, fortunately, I'm not. But if I were in Congress right now, I would be saying, this is crazy. This is nuts. We are not going to bail out these companies. I mean, just consider the mind-boggling position that so many of these companies are. Here, Henry Paulson. Where'd my papers go? Here we go. Henry Paulson, Jr., I'm looking at Forbes.com, right? Forbes.com/list/2006/12/VY36.html. This is the Henry Paulson. This is the Forbes puts together this list of the top 100 executives every year, right? He's number 81 in 2006. Total compensation, $16.4 million. 5-year compensation total, $46.74 million. Mr. Paulson has been with the company for 15 years. Stock owned in Goldman Sachs, $632.4 million worth. The industry standard, by the way, is $500,000 worth. He owned in 2006, according to Forbes, $632 million worth of stock in Goldman Sachs. Then we go to the Independent of the UK. This from 2006 also. We're back in 2006. The headline, $521,000, the average pay of Goldman Sachs employees, and that includes secretaries. The article by Stephen Foley, they call it Goldmine Sachs, and well, they might because the Wall Street giant has become the first major investment bank to see its average salary top $500,000. Hank Paulson, the chairman and chief executive, was paid $38 million in salary, shares, and options, an average figure per staff member of $521,000, burst through a barrier not even breached during the dot-com boom in 1999 and 2000. Wall Street banks are paying out a record $21.5 billion in bonuses for 2005, according to New York State figures. Then we go to Bloomberg, Bloomberg News. And this is now present day. Headline, Paulson plan. Keep in mind, Paulson was the CEO of Goldman Sachs. He was there 16 years. The headline, Paulson debt plan may benefit mostly Goldman, Morgan, the two investment banks. Bloomberg by Jody Shen. Goldman Sachs Group, Inc. and Morgan Stanley may be among the biggest beneficiaries of the $700 billion U.S. plan to buy assets from financial companies, while many banks see limited aid, according to Bank America Corp. Jeffrey Rosenberg, Bank of America's head of credit strategy research, wrote in a report dated yesterday, quote, its benefits, this is the bailout plan, in its current form will be largely limited to investment banks. Well, the investment banks are Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, who, by the way, yesterday announced that they're not going to be investment banks anymore once they get their bailout. They're going to go back to being safe. Safe and profitable, but not insanely profitable. But I would submit to you that in a very large sense, we are even asking the wrong question, much less offering the wrong remedies. And here's there's economicpopulist.org, great blog, title, people are asking the wrong question. I believe in giving credit where credit is due. Let me first of all share with you Henry Paulson, former CEO of Goldman Sachs, 2006, owner of $600 million worth of stock in Goldman Sachs, the guy who goes on Face the Nation this last weekend, this Sunday, and talks with Bob Schieffer, CBS News' show, about the stock market and the bailout and what they're planning. And what I want you to pay close attention to is this phrase, frozen assets.
Now, what did I see going on? Last week, you watched the equity markets, the stock markets, which most people see, drop by 1,000 points, then rally by 1,000 points on the news of this program. But underneath the surface, credit markets, capital markets were freezing up. And when the capital markets freeze up, then mainstream American companies have trouble raising money to do their job.
Sounds great, right?
The job is buying these illiquid assets to unclog the system and let the credit markets work the way they need to and to restore confidence.
Right.
Because the system is frozen, there's not a market for them.
Yeah, the system is frozen. It's clogged. Do you get that? Now, let me just tell you, there is some truth to what he's saying. In fact, there's a lot of truth to what he's saying. But the question that we should be asking is, will this bailout do more harm than good? Will it even work? I submit to you that what this administration is trying to do is not fix the system. Obviously, they're not trying to fix the system. There's nothing systemic in this. They're not trying to stop another Great Depression from happening. If they were trying to stop, if they were trying to do something like that, it would be much, much more structural. What they're trying to do is buy 6 weeks. The election is 6 weeks from today. They're trying to buy 6 weeks. Now, again, remember the audio you just heard, Mr. Paulson, talking about these frozen markets, right? The frozen
credit markets, capital markets were freezing up.
Okay. Now, let me take you to an article from the New York Times, October 8th, 1931. This is while Herbert Hoover is still president, a Republican is president of the United States. And the Republican, keep in mind, we were in the Great Depression. We were in a serious something like a depression or recession. Things were pretty bad. And so Republican President Herbert Hoover says we need to pump money into the system. And they did, by the way. They pump money into the system to basically bail out the banks. And here's from the article from October 8th, 1931, as ferreted out by the blogger over at economicpopulist.org. The headline, Real Estate Men on Hoover Plan. Skepticism as to President Hoover's plan to liquidate frozen bank assets was expressed yesterday by Charles G. Edwards, president of the Real Estate Securities Exchange. The exchange deals almost exclusively in real estate bonds, of which it is estimated that $1.5 billion at par value are in default throughout the country. A little later on in the article, they quote another investment banker. President Hoover's financial plan, Joseph P. Day said in part, is a step in the right direction toward making real estate investment more liquid. Get it unclogged. The system will make it possible for the Federal Reserve Bank to issue acceptance notes against real estate securities, thus stabilizing their values. This is exactly what Paulson said on Sunday he wants to do. Real estate mortgages are commonly regarded in banking as frozen assets. The Hoover plan seems to take these substantial investments from the frozen asset class and give them a recognized value. End of quote. This is from one of the cheerleaders for the Hoover plan. Well, the Hoover plan, they did the Hoover plan. And what happened? All the banks in America, virtually all the banks in America, failed. It bailed out the fat cats. The fat cats got out of their, you know, they got out. But it didn't bail out the average guy. Japan tried the same thing in 1998. They tried to recapitalize their banks, is what they called it, rather than, you know, unfreezing assets. 60 trillion yen, this is 12% of GDP of Japan. And then 6 months later, they dropped another 7.5 trillion yen into 15 banks. What happened? It didn't work. In fact, Yasushika Shiozaki, youngish legislator from the governing Liberal Democratic Party. Again, you can read this over at economicpopulist.org. We are standing at the same divide where we were standing 2 years ago when we recapitalized the banks. What we found out with Sogo, see, after they did this, the banks just kept failing, and Sogo was a huge bank that failed. What we found out with Sogo and afterwards is that the essential and fundamental problems of the Japanese economy were still there, or perhaps even worse. The Hoover bailout of the banks and the very wealthy in 1931 was a failure. The Japanese bailout of the banks and the very wealthy in 1998 was a failure. So if we're going to spend $700 billion, or $800 or $900 or a trillion or whatever it's going to end up being, if we're going to spend $700 billion doing something, what should we do instead of cash for trash? I'll tell you right after the break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Eamon Jevers writing over at, Politico. Lawmakers raised doubts Monday about what would happen if it doesn't work. Failure isn't an option. They say there's no plan B. We're talking about a serious depression. What if we're already in one? What if we're already in one? I submit to you that we are, that we have sent our manufacturing capacity offshore. We no longer make things in the United States anymore. Back in the 30s, about 7% of the public workforce was government employees. Now it's pushing 30%. I mean, we have lost a massive amount of our manufacturing capability. And our trade deficit is so huge. What's happening is we are having to borrow every day, or we're having to sell off every day, billions of dollars worth of America in order to finance our $800 billion a year trade deficit. In other words, every year we have to sell $800 billion worth of American assets, America, our companies, our land, our houses, to foreigners to give them the money, to get back the dollars that we gave them in the first place for the junk that we bought at Walmart. So here today in the front page of the Financial Times, the headline, fears emerge over U.S. bailout. Morgan Stanley said it was set to sell a stake of 10 to 20%. This is remember Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, the two big the investment banks? Morgan Stanley is going to sell 20% of their company, I'll just read it straight. Morgan Stanley said it was set to sell a stake of 10 to 20% to the Mitsubishi UFJ Financial Group, MUFJ, in a deal worth $9 billion. The news came just hours after Nomura, Japan's largest broker, confirmed that it was buying Lehman Brothers operations in Asia, and it was in exclusive talks to secure parts of its business in Europe. The dollar, by the way, fell 2% against a basket of major currencies. The euro rose 2.6%, biggest one-day rise ever. Oil went up, biggest one-day rise ever. In fact, they had to trip the circuit breaker on the commodities exchange and say stop. On Sunday, Morgan Stanley, this is from today, from again back to the Financial Times. On Sunday, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs gave up on attempts to remain as the only two standalone investment banks and became bank holding companies. to gain permanent access to Federal Reserve funds. See, what we have here is a shadow banking system, a phony banking system, an underground banking system, a separate banking system. That's what's in crisis. The real banking system, to the extent that there's a crisis in the real banking system, is a result of the shadow banking system. The shadow banking system should be shut down. Just shut it down. And then what we should do with the $700 billion is we should give it, if we're going to invest $700 billion, let's put it into the hands of average, hardworking Americans who will then spend it and create demand. And at the same time, let's make sure that that demand is fulfilled by manufacturing in the United States of America by going back to a system of trade tariffs where we say, listen, if there's 20 cents worth of labor, or if there's a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes made in Connecticut, and you can make that same pair of shoes in China for 20 cents, then when you import that pair of shoes into the United States, you're going to pay an 80-cent import tariff. So it doesn't matter where you make it, you're going to pay a buck for the labor. Or if they cost 50 cents worth of labor in Mexico to make, when you import them into the United States, you're going to pay a 50-cent import tariff. Or if it costs 80 cents to make them in Canada for labor, and it's a buck in the United States, you're going to pay a 20-cent import tariff when you bring them into the United States. Wherever you make them, we're going to bring back our manufacturing capability to this country. Start taxing companies on their offshore operations and offshore profits. I mean, let's just do the simple structural stuff. And then you want to take $700 billion in government money and put it into something? Let's do like Franklin Roosevelt did and give people jobs again. There are so many things that need to be done in this country. We've got infrastructure that's falling apart. We don't need to create make-work jobs like Roosevelt. Many of Roosevelt's projects, dams and rivers and bridges and schools, obviously all of that stuff. But we've got cities that are falling apart in America. We can put people back to work tomorrow morning. $700 billion would frankly not even really begin to address the infrastructure needs of America. When, people started looking after the bridge failed in Minneapolis, St. Paul, in the Twin Cities. And it looks like we've got a deficit since the Reagan years. Since the federal government stopped spending money on infrastructure, and a lot of state and county and local governments just didn't have the money to spend money on infrastructure, we've generated a deficit of over $1 trillion. It's $1 trillion worth of work that needs to be done. Let's do that work. Let's rebuild this country and give the money not to the investment bankers, not to the shadow banking system, not to Goldman Sachs, not to people like Henry Paulson and his heirs at Goldman Sachs. Screw them. Give the money to working people, paying them a decent wage. And they will then in turn go to their local stores and say, I want to buy things. And you will see the system unclog like that. Because when we tried it in 31, the way that Paulson's trying right now, it didn't work, but it did at 35.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white sheds? You will find the bigger piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean shirts to play.
Oh, they always have such nice clean shirts, those bigger piggies. The Wall Street Journal reports, this, by the way, from thinkprogress.org, the lobbyists for Wall Street firms have dispensed with traditionally subtle lobbying techniques and launched an aggressive campaign to ensure that the terms of the Treasury's proposed bailout are favorable to the finance industry. Yeah. They also want to make sure that homeowners are not going to be bailed out, that only bankers are bailed out. Who are the guys who are part of this? Major player in the effort is the Financial Services Roundtable, quote, a lobbying group representing the nation's banks, end quote, with significant ties to Senator John McCain's presidential campaign. Member lobbyists for the roundtable, according to Mother Jones' report, include former Representative Susan Molinari, McCain campaign fundraiser, member of Women for McCain Committee, and co-chair of Honest and Open Election Committee. Excuse me. Carlos Bonilla, or is it Bonilla? I'm not sure. Former McCain campaign economic advisor. David Crane, McCain campaign fundraiser and former aide to McCain at the Senate Commerce Committee. Samuel Gedolgig, McCain campaign fundraiser. Former Senator Phil Graham, while not a lobbyist for the roundtable, Graham did address the group as a McCain surrogate at the RNC. Yeah. Number one, they want to expand the size and scope of the bailout. In fact, they have already got Paulson to say, you know, oh, yeah, we'll go beyond just American banks. They want to try and increase the size of the bailout to $1.4 trillion, by the way. That's doubling it. And second, to block struggling homeowners from benefiting from the bailout. Right. We don't need no stinking struggling homeowners. I mean, that, you know, we don't need that, right? Fact of the matter is, if you consider the cash involved, the amounts of money involved in this thing, $700 billion divided by a million homes, okay, is $700,000 per home. Divided by 2 million homes, $350,000 per home. Divided by 4 million homes, $175,000 per home. If we really have a crisis right now in the United States with our homes, and in fact, according to the New York Times back in June, an article that I shared with you, in fact, those of you who are regular listeners will remember that I went off on a substantial rant as a consequence of this June 6th article. 1 in 11 mortgage holders face loan problems. 8.8% of American homes are past due or in foreclosure. That's a little over 4 million homes. 4 million homes, okay? If you take 4 million homes and you gave each one of those 4 million homeowners $175,000 and said, okay, we're paying off your bank, we're paying off your mortgage, you owe it to us now, it's a 30-year note, you can pay it back at a low interest rate. This is what Roosevelt did, by the way. Actually, they didn't even pay off the mortgages. They just said, you know, okay, the bank, because the banks were already bust. The banks are bankrupt. Just say, okay, we've got a $700 billion line of credit. The banks, they're toast. This is not rocket science. I am just astounded that people are being stampeded by this thing. One of the folks in our chat room, El Buenora, said, hand us $700 billion in unmarked bills, America, and no funny stuff like following us or the economy gets it. Might still get it, but anyway, give us the money. I mean, this is where it's going. This is how weird it has gotten. By the way, our Mike Toth, who does our audio archives, was able to sneak into a McCain town hall meeting, and he surreptitiously recorded a minute of John McCain.
We can't bust heads like we used to. But we have our ways. One trick is to tell them stories that don't go anywhere. Like the time I caught the ferry over to Shelbyville, I needed a new heel for my shoe. So I decided to go to Morganville, which is what they called Shelbyville in those days. So I tied an onion to my belt, which was the style of...
And on it goes. Oh, thank you very much, Mike, for that. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Let's see, Ray in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Ray, quick note. What's up?
I think we can make a lot of money right away by pulling all our boys back from all these excursions of the Bush illegal war.
Yep.
Cut off the Pentagon and
yep.
all these contracts.
$750 billion a year the Pentagon is costing us. We've got over 700 bases around the world. It's crazy. We don't need to be an empire. You're spot on, Ray. Very well said. Gino in Portland. Hey, Gino.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Hey, I just would like to know when somebody's going to start talking about prosecuting these individuals who have taken our financial market and turned it into a dump. And also,
here's the problem, Gino. What they did is not illegal because Phil Graham changed the law in 1990, because Ronald Reagan changed the law, because the Republicans and a fair number of Democrats, actually. Bill Clinton signed off on the changes of the law because they changed the laws. We can't convict these guys of crimes because we made legal what they did. And there were people at the time who were saying, and I was among them, who were saying, this is nuts. Don't do this. Bernie Sanders Sanders was out there screaming about it in 1999. Do you realize what this is going to do? What they did is legal. That's why they can't go to jail. Evan in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, Evan.
Hello. Let's see. In this proposal in Section 6, this says that the Secretary's authority to purchase is limited to $700 billion at any one time.
That's right. So he can buy $700 billion worth of securities, sell them for $600 billion, and then so now he has $600 billion back. He gets another $100 billion from the Treasury, and he goes out and buys another $700 billion.
He can do it again.
Yeah.
In another, between now and the next 2 years, you can do that over and over again.
Right. And in fact, Henry Paulson said he intends to recycle the money over and over again. But basically what he's asking for is a $700 billion line of credit. And yeah. This is nuts. This is nuts. Marilyn in Los Angeles. Hey, Marilyn.
Tom, I could really use your help framing phone calls, because there's another issue that's sort of falling through the cracks here, and that is bringing Rove in and holding him in contempt and
yes.
sanctioning him.
Yeah.
So that
we have less than a week. You know, the Congress is going to be in session before the election recess. Call your member of Congress and tell them that they need to vote to hold Karl Rove in contempt of Congress.
As opposed to jumping the gun on the bailout. Right?
Well, I think I think that you need to keep these things separate. If you call up and you say, I'm opposed to the bailout, and by the way, convict Karl Rove, basically one message is going to get through as a vote from a constituent to the member of Congress. So I would simply call and or make two calls, you know.
Maybe.
But I would not conflate the two issues. Congress can chew gum and walk at the same time. I would just do it that way, Marilyn, but that's what I do. Hack in Decatur, Illinois. Hey, Hack.
Yes, sir. I'm great. How are you?
Great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'll get better, too, but they're kicking me out of my short positions and won't let me sell anymore.
Yeah.
That $700 billion, the day it's approved at the end of this quarter, will be absorbed instantaneously by the hedge funds and the international investment fund groups are going to just hit it hard at the end of this quarter.
You're absolutely right, and that's why I keep saying, Hack, and you're spot on right. I've said this over and over again. These guys are not trying to save the system. They're trying to buy 6 weeks, because it's 6 weeks to the election. It's that simple. Alan in St. Louis. Hey, Alan.
Hey, Tom.
Yeah.
Okay, last night I was listening to Naomi Klein, and she referred to Paulson as Mr. Risk. That's what he was known on Wall Street.
Right.
Okay. 2 years ago, he gamed the system by doing all this. And then and now, watching him on TV today, he's sitting there screaming, he's all for oversight. Actually,
he says he's all for oversight, but the three-page document that he put out saying, give me the money, says that there will be no oversight.
Right.
Nobody can do oversight. Nobody can look at what's going on. And that's the crime. I mean, this is, you know, it's like that moment in Blazing Saddles where the guy puts, you know, the sheriff puts the gun to his head and says, you know, back off or I'll shoot, right? Paulson is putting a gun to his own head and saying, back off or I'll shoot. We should say, fine, pull the trigger. Richard in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Tom, you're eloquent as ever. Listen, I was on your program when you had Robbie Botcher on a few times ago, and I mentioned the number, and you were right to bring up Helen Hodgson Brown's article, The Web of Debt, where she quotes from the Bank of International Settlements, the amount of these derivatives globally is $1,000 trillion in value.
That's right.
There is no bailout that's going to help that.
That's my point. Let the shadow banking system die. You're absolutely right. $1,000 trillion worth of derivatives out there. We're talking about a $7 billion. That's 7/10 of one. That's 0.7 trillion. Less than 1 trillion is this bailout. There's $1,000 trillion worth of derivatives out there. A lot of them are, probably most of them are very flaky. I mean, this is a giant casino operation that's going on. Let it die. Let's build a real banking system in the United States. Let's put this country back together. That's what Roosevelt did. He came in after Herbert Hoover in 1931, bailed out the banks, bailed out the rich guys in 1931. After that happened, the banks still failed because the shadow system was still there and it was still broken and it was still screwed up. And FDR came in and said, we're going to put this thing back together by putting money in the pockets of working people. To hell with the banks. To hell with the shadow banking system. Let them go. We're going to look out for the average guy. And that's what's so different, by the way, between the kind of rhetoric that we're hearing from McCain and the Republicans and what FDR did. There's no lineage to FDR in this at all. It's the complete opposite.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Oh, where'd that come from? It's our full Monty alert. Portland police took a waterfront Lady Godiva down a notch this week. Barely. They were getting calls about a nude skater whizzing past tourists and rush hour commuters. But you can do that in Oregon. Or occasional nude bike rides draw police only for crowd control. And shows featuring live sex acts are protected as free speech. The skater, Jennifer Moss, a.k.a. Earth Friend Jen, the naked protester, asked organizers for permission this summer to skate naked in the city of Ashland's 4th of July parade. She didn't get that. Police told her to tone it down after construction workers complained. Complained? So, anyway, police responded and said they were just concerned about her safety. 866-303-22. We got to have a little bit of levity in here. Jerry in Santa Maria, California. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, you know, I fully agree with you. This is a systemic problem. The real estate bubble was created because we're only 16% industrial.
Yep.
All our industrial base was sent overseas, so
the only place money
could go was in real estate.
Yep. In fact, the last number I saw was 14 and change percent industrial, you know, as a percentage of total GDP. And financial services is pushing over 30%. It used to be the other way around. These numbers are upside down. They are absolutely upside down. You're absolutely right, and that's what we need to fix. Kevin in Missouri. Hey, Kevin.
Tom.
Yeah.
I listened to a few minutes of the Bernanke and Cox and Paulson testimony this morning, and there were three questions asked in quick succession that tells me everything I need to know about this plan and that it is a boondoggle. Number one, they could not name any other option that they considered in deliberation before they presented this plan. Number two, they will not guarantee or cannot guarantee it works, and quite frankly did not sound very confident in that it would. And number three, there's no mechanism to stop foreclosures other than to make money available for people to refinance a house that they couldn't afford to begin with.
Right. Or, yeah, absolutely. And very simply, they could solve that problem by simply changing the rules of the mortgages. And who gets burned on that? The people who bought these things second, two, three, four, five times these mortgages were recycled in the market where these guys were going out and saying, hey, I sold this guy a mortgage at a 3% initial rate and he doesn't even realize that 4 years or 5 years, or maybe he does realize he thought he could flip the house, you know, because we got him all excited because, hey, you got to make money in today's market, right? That's how you make money. You don't make money by having a real job because there are no real jobs anymore. You try to buy a house and have the value go up and then sell it and flip it on another. So anyhow, he got this mortgage and it's going to kick up to 12-16% in 5 years. So therefore, I'm going to sell you that mortgage for a whole pile of money because it's going to be worth so much when that kicks up to 16%. And they bundled all these things together and then the banks sold them to banks and they sold them into the derivatives market and blah, blah, blah. And out it goes into the world, billions of dollars representing not, you know, trillions of dollars. Representing not necessarily trillions of dollars of real equity because they were selling derivatives, they were selling bets against these things and bets for them as well. And all of it, it's all crazy. Let's just let it all go down. Naomi Klein is right. This is the shock doctrine. This is the destruction of America. This is the skimming of the cream. It's what Herbert Hoover did in 1931. It's the Republican president. It's being done again. This is the skimming of the last of the cream. And what we, the American people, are going to be left with is the thinnest of skimmed milk, right? We're going to be left with a thin gruel. AJ in Los Angeles. Hey, AJ.
Hi. I'm really very concerned about the bailout of these financial institutions. Basically, the definition of banking means people who have surplus money, they invest money with the banks, and people who need money, they borrow.
Right.
So if the people invest money with a 3% rate of interest, the money lent is 6%. The
right.
difference between that is the bank's expenses of the running expenses.
Right, plus profit. Yeah, none of this is banking. All of this, AJ, is gambling. We are bailing out. Goldman Sachs was involved in what they called investment banking, not traditional banking. And
yes.
that is also known as gambling. And they got caught.
So what's happening now? They are being given tax dollars. Now,
that's right.
We pay tax, and those tax dollars are going to be given to these banks. These banks are going to lend us our tax dollars and charge interest.
Yeah.
So we end up paying taxes, and then we end up paying interest on our tax dollars. So
yeah.
it's double taxation.
And they're going to do that, by the way, after, and thank you very much, AJ, and they're going to do that after they pay themselves huge bonuses. This is from ABC News. In 2007, Wall Street's five biggest firms, five companies, Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley, put a record $39 billion, paid a record $39 billion in bonuses to themselves. That's $10 billion more than the $29 billion loan taxpayers are making to J.P. Morgan to save Bear Stearns. Those 2007 bonuses were paid even though the shareholders in those firms collectively lost $74 billion in stock declines. That's from ABC News. And then consider this from Bill Moyers' report. He says, during the last 5 years of his tenure as CEO of now bankrupt Lehman Brothers, Richard Full's total take was $354 million. John Thain, the current chairman of Merrill Lynch, taken over this week by Bank of America, which, by the way, is partly owned by Japanese and Saudi companies, has been on the job for just 9 months. He pocketed a $15 million signing bonus. His predecessor, Stan O'Neill, had a package of $161 million after the company reported an $8 billion loss in a single quarter. And remember, James Cain had a Bear Stearns, $60 million. Daniel Mudd and Richard Styron, former heads of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they're fighting to keep their severance packages at $24 million. I mean, this is absolutely over the top. It is absolutely over the top. Steve in Richmond, Virginia. Hey, Steve, real quick.
Oh, hey. I was watching CBS. I believe the show is called This Morning, but I'm not 100% sure, and also Stephanopoulos. And an interesting thing happened. The person on CBS actually was talking about this bailout and actually said she made the statement that Congress is hoping that this that the economy responds to this dose of, quote, shock therapy. She actually used the word shock therapy, which I found very interesting.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for sharing that. As I said, Naomi Klein is right. This is a kleptocracy. The Republican Party, since the 1880s, has been a party of kleptocrats, thieves.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. John Burlaw is on the line with us. He's the director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Conservative think tank, CEI.org, is their website. Hey, John, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be on, Tom.
John, in 1931, Herbert Hoover gave a speech about frozen markets, a phrase that we heard a lot and we're hearing a lot about right now, and basically bailed out the banks. A whole lot of money got passed through to bail out the banks. Same thing happened in Japan in 1998. They bailed out the banks. They bailed out the bankers. In both cases, it didn't work. In 31, the banks still collapsed, and Roosevelt came in and had to put the thing back together. And for the Japanese, it didn't work. In fact, the Japanese are quite explicit today in saying it didn't work. Why are we trying to do it now?
I don't know, and we certainly at CEI don't buy into this Wall Street socialism.
That's great. So you are a conservative, I am a liberal, and we're both looking at this going, there's something really profoundly, deeply wrong with this. What's, you know, my take on what's wrong with it is I'm not all that opposed to socialism. I'm not, but I don't think this is socialism. I mean, this isn't helping the people. You know, you could argue that health care for all is socialism. You could argue that unemployment insurance and Social Security are forms of socialism. This is none of the above. This is giving billionaires more billions.
I think so too. And you've already, and it's going to hurt, you know, some of the smaller banks. By subsidizing, putting the guarantee to money market accounts, the Community Bankers Association of America said this will drain money, you know, from savings accounts and community banks. Force, you know, through mark-to-market accounting rules, which we write more on CEI.org and openmarket.org, if the government faces the dilemma, if it pays too low for an asset, all the other banks, you know, even that have loans still performing will have to take this loss on their books, and it could even trigger more waves of losses. So there are already flaws to it, you know, with what little we know, and we don't know what will be in the final details of this.
Right, and your suggestion is do away with mark-to-market. I'm guessing that discussion will be sufficiently arcane that a lot of our listeners will be, you know, scratching their heads about it. But basically, I guess the bottom line would be that right now, the way the regulations are set up, assets have to be priced based on their market value. That's called mark-to-market. And Paulson has defended this, by the way, and as you well know. And you're suggesting that should be done away with, that asset prices should be basically unregulated?
Well, no. It was mark-to-market has only come in the past few years. I mean,
right.
The justification being with some justification that banks, you know, don't hide bad assets. The problem is,
well, it came about, didn't it, as a result of the SNL collapse
and the Japanese banks. The problem is there isn't like a market like the stock market for some of the loans with loans in general, or some of these loans with unique features. And in a panic, a market can disappear. So somebody could still be holding, a bank could be holding a loan that will still pay for 25 years and the cash is coming in. But if a bad bank, a highly leveraged bank down the street, sells a similar loan, accountants will force, you know, all the good banks to mark down their books as well.
Right. So let me give you you asked the question, why would they do this? Perhaps rhetorically, let me give you a perhaps concrete answer. We're talking with John Berlow, director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. What if this really is the last great wave of consolidation? What if what we're looking at here is the cancer stage of capitalism, the stage that Marx talked about in Das Kapital, where I don't know if you've read the book, but while I absolutely disagree with his prescriptions, I think his analysis of the problems of capitalism were pretty solid, and that is that without something that prevents eventually the medium-sized fish from eating all the small fish, and then the largest among them from eating all the other medium-sized fish, and they're ending up being nothing but one or two large fish in the pond. Without something to prevent that from happening, that's what you're going to get. In the cancer stage of capitalism, in the end game of capitalism, you end up with just four or five major players in every single industry, and it's impossible for entrepreneurs to get into the market. It's impossible for small businesses to start out. And I'd say the fact, if you look, you know, back ever since Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in 1982, in 82, you could walk into any shopping mall in America and 75-80% of the stores were locally owned. Today, none of them are locally owned. All the mom and pop shops, or the vast majority of them across this country, are out of business. Back in the 80s, from the beginning of this country up until the 1980s, people would start a business with the idea of passing it down to their children and grandchildren multi-generationally. Now people start a business hoping that they can get it big enough in 2 years that they can sell it to Microsoft before Microsoft squashes them like a bug. Could it be that the reason why they want to maintain mark-to-market is they want to drive these small banks out of business? They want to drive all the small guys out of business and just end up with nothing but Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan?
I think that could very well be some of the justification. I can't get in anybody's head, but it gets to the point that sometimes regulation can lead to consolidation if the small guys can't keep up on the regulatory costs.
Well, this, okay, so you and I are arguing the same thing from different points of view. You're saying this is a consequence of regulation. I'm saying it's a consequence of deregulation. Although, you know, in the case of mark-to-market, you could make the case that that regulation is helping this, but it's a regulation that the banking industry asked for.
Yes, a lot of them did. In fact, the thing is, it can, I know I don't want to get into an arcane accounting discussion, but it can inflate assets, during a boom time.
Right. That's why the banking industry lobbied to have mark-to-market put in the first place.
Yes, I mean a lot of that you do get. There's a book by a former colleague of mine, The Big Ripoff. A lot of times you do get big business lobbying for regulation to hurt their
company. Almost all the time, John. I look at Monsanto, for example. During Bush 1, they were developing genetically modified organisms, and there were no laws and no rules whatsoever. They wanted to be able to lock that market down, so they went to Bush 1, and Dan Quayle and the group, the working group, put together the initial regulations on GMOs that allowed Monsanto to lock that stuff down. I mean, that for example.
Yep. I mean, that sounds like I don't know everything, but that would sound like there have been examples like that.
Oh yeah, I mean, I wrote a book called Unequal Protection. There's a chapter, an entire chapter in the book about all the ways that regulation is lobbied for by business and then used to consolidate business. It's basically using government to again lead us into this cancer stage of capitalism to the death. You know, I would submit to you that Franklin Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself, and that when Reagan came along and started dismantling these regulations or dismantling the government protections and replacing them with very specific rules that industry wanted, that government became an instrument of industry rather than a regulator of industry. I mean, there has to be some superstructure within which contracts are enforced, some infrastructure within which the rules of the game are clearly identified. Without rules for a football game, you've got a mess. You don't have a football game. So there has to be, markets don't exist in a vacuum. There has to be some sort of government, something there to make it all possible to enforce the rules, to have courts, to have jails for the malefactors. You'll give me that, right?
Yes, and that's actually why one of the reasons we don't want this bailout. I mean, because of that people shouldn't be subsidized, businesses shouldn't, the failure shouldn't be socialized if the profits are privatized.
My mom
has said that for years.
Okay, so John Berlau, you as a conservative are saying no to this bailout bill. Me as a liberal, I'm saying no to this bailout bill. I'm suggesting that if they're going to take $700 billion of borrowed money, first of all, it shouldn't be borrowed money. They should be raising taxes and be honest about it if they really think that it's all that important. And if they're going to do it, let's rebuild the infrastructure of the United States. We've got over $1 trillion worth of crumbling infrastructure right now. That would put a lot of people back to work tomorrow who could then use that money to buy things generating demand and pay their mortgages. What's your alternative?
My alternative is we still have huge, Social Security and Medicare, things like that. And, possibly I would recommend a tax cut, maybe, a corporate tax cut, for all corporations, not for a special, a Wall Street few.
So you're saying use this as an opportunity to privatize Social Security and Medicare?
That would be better than doing this than having this socialism for Wall Street. But maybe
right.
It seems like there are a lot of socialists on Wall Street at bad times.
Yeah, it does. I get it that's going to be step two. In fact, this John McCain has for a long time been an advocate of privatizing Social Security and an opponent of Medicare. And if we have a McCain-Palin presidency or a Palin-McCain presidency, I predict that's what we'll see is that will be step two. Just like Paulson is, got the head to his gun and he says, don't come any closer or I'll shoot. Gun to his head, excuse me. They're going to do the same thing, only they're going to say, we can't afford Social Security.
I don't know what they're going to do, but
yeah.
This bailout's a bad thing.
Yeah, well, we'll see. John Berlau, Director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org is their website. John, thanks for dropping by. Interesting
Thank
to get
you.
Your take on this. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's like I gotta be hot and cold.
Well, I think we could have predicted that the conservatives would say, oh, yeah, we have a crisis. Let's use it to privatize Social Security. The fact of the matter is Social Security is fine and is going to be fine for the next 43 years. And if we simply lift the cap so that Bill Gates pays the same a percentage of his income in Social Security taxes as you and I do, it'll be fine forever. In fact, it'll have a nice surplus forever. Anyhow, yesterday we had John Berlow on the Wall Street Journal, former Wall Street Journal writer and author of a new book, actually a reissued version of a book about talking about voter fraud, our voting alert here.
Just a touch of a screen.
His name is John Fun. Yeah.
Welcome to the future.
So our voting machine alert. Brad Friedman is with us. He is the editor-in-chief of bradblog.com. And, Brad, you're one of the guys out there who's doing really, really great work reporting on the nature and state of election fraud across the United States and over at bradblog.com. And I just wanted to get your update on what the state of affairs, the real state of affairs is.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that because John Fund has been really on the forefront of going out there and, pardon the L word here, but lying to the American people about what's going on with this, making this ridiculous case of voter fraud as he did yesterday when he was on your show. I mean, it's really reprehensible. And, you know, the more.
Well, my point to him was, you know, how many people have been convicted of this? Well, maybe a couple of thousand nationwide at the very most. I mean,
oh, no,
this is,
not even close, Tom.
Oh, I know. And this is a problem without a problem.
Yeah. Exactly. It's a phony scam out and out to keep Democratic-leaning voters from being able to cast their legal vote, period. I mean, we're talking right. about Bush's own Department of Justice from 2001 to 2005, I believe, had 21 convictions across the nation for voter fraud, and they weren't even voter fraud. Most of them were, you know, registration fraud, you know, people that never actually voted. You hear about, and John Fund loves to talk about, you know, these Democrats signing up Mary Poppins and Dick Tracy to go vote. Well, they never voted. And, you know, these were a couple of rogue folks who were working, being paid by the registration, who wanted to make more money, so they put in, you know, Mary Poppins. They never voted. Furthermore, their favorite whipping boy has become this group Acorn, which is doing yeoman's work and signing up millions of voters across low-income voters across the country. They, in fact, verify every single registration that they get, and they call them. And if they can't get verified that it's legitimate, they flag it as potentially fraudulent, and then they turn it in because they have to by law. And the thing
so we can, I think we can just safely dispose of the whole voter fraud argument, Brad Friedman, and bradblog.com, and instead let's look at election fraud. What's the state in the couple minutes we have left here? What is the state of election fraud in the United States? What can we anticipate 6 weeks from today?
Well, that is a very serious concern because Republicans all over the country are using this phony voter fraud thing to try to keep people from voting. They're getting foreclosure lists. For example, up in Michigan, people who have been foreclosed on their homes are going to use those to challenge folks at the polls.
Right.
Down in Florida, they're doing this no match, no vote. And I think you mentioned that yesterday, if I recall, where, you know, if I'm registered as Brad Friedman, but my driver's license says Bradley L. Friedman, I'm not going to be able to vote in the state of Florida.
Right.
That's what they're doing on the front end. And I'm sorry to say the Obama and DNC campaign is not doing enough to combat that. And then you get to the point when you've got these electronic voting machines where absolutely anything can happen. And this is something else.
And has.
Yeah. What's that?
Anything can happen and has.
And has, and it's very difficult to see, very difficult to find, because it's hidden inside the code. If they want to mess with these machines, you will never know it. And that's the danger of these systems. And Fund yesterday said to you, well, I'd love to do something else, but there is no other way other than using computers, which is simply nonsense. Up in New Hampshire, you know, 20% of the ballots are counted on paper by hand, and Fund says that's the easiest way to defraud the system. Nonsense. If it's done publicly so that everyone can see it, people are going to try to game elections. But when you can see it, you can stop it. When it's inside a computer, you can't. And if you have to use computers, because he asked, you know, how else you could do it, For example, a great case is Oklahoma. Oklahoma purchased their optical scan systems years ago, and I'm not crazy about op scans, but what they did was purchase the machines and then threw out the voting machine companies. They run the entire system themselves. They have an IT department. It's all publicly overseen rather than privatized, as we've seen everywhere else in the country, not just with the voting machines now, but with the voter rolls that, you know, the voting machine companies did such a lousy job on the voting machines, a lot of states have hired them to run, to privatize their voting rolls. So people have to make sure, even if they've voted in the recent primary, they need to call their registrar, their state. They need to find out, and votersunite.org has a great little tool that you can click on, and it says, are you registered? For all 50 states, you can find out if you're registered. Do not presume that you are before November.
Brad Freeman, is the website, the resources, votersunite.org, your favorite?
It's one of them. Yeah, it's a real good one.
And you have a list of them over at bradblog.com?
That's correct.
Okay, great. Brad Freeman, bradblog.com, doing yeoman's work himself on identifying election fraud all across the United States and outing the companies and the individuals and the political party that is behind so much of it. Thanks a lot, Brad.
Thank you, Tom.
Keep up the great work. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Testimony before Congress this morning, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson has sweetened the pot with an offer to send free KY jelly to every American taxpayer along with the bill for their share of the bailout. Yeah. On the other hand, conservatives were not necessarily the other. Oh, man, the metaphors are going to start getting really difficult now. Anyhow, Fred Barnes, Weekly Standard Fred Barnes, yes, that conservative fellow, it says, we just need to change the language. Here he is on Fox News yesterday. Here he is.
Come on, that a lot of the terms of how the Treasury Department acquires these illiquid assets, and they want to set the terms saying that, that set a cap on executives' pay and say that the federal government should get an equity share in some of these companies. You know, we'd be in a better situation, or at least the Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson would be, if this were known as a rescue rather than a bailout. Bailout sounds terrible. Who's for a bailout? A lot of people are for a rescue.
Yeah, everybody's in favor of rescue, Fred. We need to rescue those rich bankers from themselves.
Ann in San Diego, California. Hey, Ann, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for all you do. How am I supposed to protect my own money, which is not very much in these rocky times? I'm calling reps and doing what I can to not have this pass, but if it does, what do I do?
You know, Ann, back in the 90s, oddly enough, in the 90s, it seems like forever ago.
I know.
I thought we were here. I thought we were close because I'd for 15, 18 years, 20 years, I'd been watching American infrastructure be hollowed out. Our trade deficit was exploding. Our jobs were being shipped overseas. It just seemed to me like the thing couldn't hold together. Louise and I sold a business in 96 in Atlanta. We sold an ad agency and moved to Vermont and bought a house with a greenhouse on the side and out in the woods. And we were trying to get as self-sufficient as we could. and just, you know, hunkered down. We got a bunch of land. We had a couple of friends who bought some, built some houses on the land that we had. We had a couple hundred acres there. And we were going to essentially create a self-sufficient community. And, you know, after a couple of years, the economy didn't fall apart, and I went off and started this radio show, which has dragged me out here. And, but I mean, our friends are still back there living on that land, and we've got a bunch of friends in Vermont who are in the direction of self-sufficiency. What I envisioned is a real disaster scenario, you know, where basically we go to a barter economy, where the things that have value are things like clothing and food. And the Mormons are right, and everybody should have a year's worth of stuff stashed. And I still think that that's a very real possibility.
As to buy seeds and such.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, land and seeds and you know, the ability to make it through the winter. You know, that's not inconceivable in my mind. I don't think it's going to happen this year. I think, but it's not inconceivable over the next 10 years.
Is there any way to protect the cash I've got in the bank?
You know, the FDIC will guarantee you up to $100,000.
Well, as long as that lasts,
per account, per bank, right? Yeah, as long as that lasts. If the FDIC goes down, the federal government is going down. If the federal government goes down, having dollars won't matter.
So having seeds makes better sense, yeah.
Yeah, I think so, yeah, commodities. Or, for that matter, I mean, maybe Canadian dollars or euros or something like that. You know, this is just a really tough one, and there's a lot of us all across the United States who are trying to figure out, you know, with you know, what we have that we might be able to live on in our old age, or maybe not even enough to live on in our old age. How do we keep it from evaporating as the value of the dollar just goes away? You know, you hear the ads on this show for selling gold coins. I have invested in gold and silver coins, you know, not most of my money, but some of it. It's a starting point. But beyond that, you know, I think just getting self-sufficient. And I got to move along. Thank you very much for the call.
Bye bye.
Good luck. Yeah, it's I mean, even contemplating this stuff is rough. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph.
Hi, Tom. Follow the money.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is Paulson bailing out his own golden parachute here?
Yes, he is.
Yes, okay. Remember, he helped create this mess as chairman of Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, and again, you go back to Forbes.com and you look at the 2006 listing of the top 100 CEOs in the U.S., and here's Henry Paulson, number 81 in compensation, $16.4 million. And they list how much stock he owns, right? Salary, bonus, mm-hmm. stock gains, et cetera. And it, right there, I'm reading it from Forbes.com. Stock owned $632.4 million.
So I'm getting the chance to pay $2,333 to bail out this wealthy guy that created the whole mess in the first place.
Yeah, and if you're dividing the population of the U.S. by 700 billion, that's... or 700 billion by the population of the United States. That's really not even a good number. I would use the 115 million wage earners in the United States, because you're assuming with that $2,300 figure that babies can write checks and they can't.
Yeah, but Tom, I have one request of you.
Sure.
Play FDR's "We Have Nothing to Fear But Fear Itself" as often as you can. And also, I think...
Here you go, right here. Here you go.
Okay, one more thing.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
And he was talking about the Great Depression, not World War II.
Right, and remember one more thing, and I'll get off. My uncle was a banker during the Great Depression. FDR declared a bank holiday and saved the banks.
Yep.
I think George Bush needs to grow a couple of cojones and do two things. One is fire Paulson, and two is declare a holiday.
Yeah, the problem is that Paulson's philosophy and George Bush's philosophy, both being multimillionaires, both being from very wealthy families, both being part of the financial elite of the world, of the planet, the top, you know, 1/1000th of 1% or 1/1000000th of 1% of the planet's wealth, they share the same philosophy. He's not going to do it. But, you know, you're right, Ralph. That's what should happen. And that's what we have to do 6 weeks from today on November 4th is say, that's it. You know, we're throwing these bums out. Thanks a lot for the call, Ralph. Good to hear from you. Karen in Fort Myers, Florida. Hey, Karen.
Yeah, you just said exactly what I called about. I'm watching as a regular citizen. I have no economic degree or financial degree, but I'm watching these hearings and listening to Paulson, and it's so ridiculous. I mean, Senator Dodd said to him, you're not planning on using the whole $700 billion right away. So what if we give you $150 billion, and if you can get this started and we can then renegotiate and look at it in January and say, okay, well, it seems to be working. We'll give you a little bit more. No. His answer is no. I need it all right now, even though I'm not going to need it right now. It's a crock. And the only thing as American citizens we have left is when we go to that election is to make sure we watch every single one of our congressmen and what they vote. And if they vote yes for this bailout, then we vote no.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't go quite that far, Karen, because I guarantee you there's going to be a whole bunch of Democrats who are quaking in their boots that when the disaster happens, and it's going to, one way or the other, that they will be blamed if they vote no, and so they're not going to vote no. Because the fear stampede, it's just like the war in Iraq. The fear stampede is happening, and there's a few good people who are going to vote the wrong way on this. I guarantee you that right now. But we need to make our voices heard. We need to let them know that we will stand behind them and back them up if they vote no on this. And Chris Dodd's suggestion of, if you don't need the whole thing now, why don't we give you a little bit? I mean, why should we give them any is my take on this.
I agree.
But, if Dodd is concerned about the bank, Chris Dodd is one of the smartest guys in the Senate, and he knows banking inside out. I'll just leave it at that. Karen, thank you very much for the call. Dave in Ohio. Hey, Dave.
Oh, hi, Tom. Hey, I have full agreement with what your first hour. There is a bottom-up solution to this that is basically you have to maintain a sufficient confidence in the consumer base and
Dave, your phone is disintegrated. I'm sorry. You can give me a call some other time. James and Eugene. Hey, James, we got a little less than a minute before we got to take a break here. What's up? James? James's phone is... Yeah, you're on the air.
I was calling you about Social Security. All these Republicans keep talking about how we need to default on these treasuries that Social Security holds.
Yeah.
Why can't we default on the treasuries that are held by all these foreign countries when treasuries that are held by Americans should be defaulted on?
The practical answer is because we manufacture nothing in the United States anymore, and if we couldn't borrow money from them to then give them that money to buy stuff from them, we would be so screwed that it would be unbelievable. You'd see food riots in the United States. You'd see people shooting up each other's houses to get gasoline. You'd see, the loss of electricity. You'd see, oil just gone. I mean, that's how bad it could get if the system actually broke down. Because we are not a self-sufficient country anymore. We haven't, Ronald Reagan set us on the course of being dependent upon the rest of the world. Of being dependent upon transnational corporations. That's what this is all about. It's about the corporate takeover of the United States. 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
His demeanor is that of a maverick. His complexion is like a cadaveric. With the wind in his head, like a loaf of white bread, he always goes against the grain. The man, the myth, the McCain. He could probably quote Deuteronomy, the man, but he can't understand the economy. Who can? In his prime, in the pink, he knew Moses, I think. The two of them worked out with Jack LaLanne. The man, the myth, the McCain.
Yes, the man, the myth, the McCain. And now the press is starting to say, Mr. McCain, is this the No Talk Express, Sarah Palin? What is it, 40 days now, I think? You can't talk to her. No, you can't. Finally, CNN pushed through. They relented. They gave... They gave CNN and the New York Times, they let him sit in this morning with Palin and Karzai's meeting for a total of 29 seconds, during which time she asked him about his son, and he told her the name of his son. And then the reporters, meanwhile, the reporters are asking McCain.
Does your bus become the no-talk express?
Are you going to support the bailout plan? Are you thinking about supporting it?
Okay, Poole, back to the van.
Okay, Poole, back to the van. And that's the end of that. Meanwhile, Henry Paulson is saying, no, I didn't say I didn't want oversight. This has got to be the most disingenuous thing ever said.
Thursday night, as you'll recall, Chairman, with the leaders of Congress, you all said to us, don't give us a fait accompli. Come in and work with us. We gave you a simple three-page legislative outline. And I thought it would have been presumptuous for us on that outline to come up with an oversight mechanism. That's the role of Congress. That's something we're going to work on together. So if any of you felt that I didn't believe that we needed oversight, I believe we need oversight. We need oversight. We need protection. We need transparency. I want it. We all want it. And we need to do that in a way that lets this system, let this program work effectively, quickly, because it needs to work effectively and quickly, and it needs to get the job done.
Henry Paulson lying through his teeth to Congress. Ellen Ratner, the three-page document he provided to Congress says, and I quote, decisions by the secretary, that's Paulson, pursuant to the authority of this act are non-reviewable and committed to agency discretion and may not be reviewed by any court of law or any administrative agency, period, end of sentence. What is going on here?
Okay, well, I don't know what's going on, but he also, in addition to what you just had a clip of, he also said, when we get through this difficult period, which we will, our next task must be to address the problems in our financial system through a reform program that fixes our outdated financial regulatory structure and provides strong measures to address other flaws and excesses. Well, the issue is when we get through this difficult period. Not now, not as part of this legislation, when we get through this difficult period.
Right. And the Goldman Sachs is probably going to be one of the largest recipients of this money. And I'm looking at the Forbes.com 2006 list of the nation's most highly paid CEOs, Henry Paulson, number 81 at $16.4 million that year. And it shows that he owned at that time, and this is according to Forbes. I don't know how accurate this is, but this is what Forbes reported, and he certainly could have told them if he thought they were wrong, that he owned $632.4 million worth of Goldman stock. This is Paulson bailing himself out?
Maybe, or his buddies that he probably sits with at the World Economic Forum or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing.
This is nuts.
It's also interesting that their opensecrets.org has a list of who got what money in the late 90s. 86 million to members of Congress between 97 on the Keeg votes on the Graham-Leach-Bliley bill in November 99. And those lawmakers voting yes received about 180,000 in campaign contributions from individuals and PACs in the financial sector. Those who voted nay received about 90,000, or about half of what supporters got.
Right, and that's a cheap investment. Buy a legislator for a couple $100,000 and make billions. That's amazing. By the way, there's a website that was put up by the Impeach Bush group. It's called VoteNoBailout.org. VoteNoBailout.org. VoteNoBailout. And just let people know about that. You go to that site, you fill in your name and information, and it'll send a form letter to Congress saying no thanks on the bailout.
Also this morning, on the conference call that I was on from the White House about this package, what they said is that the CEO, you know, golden parachute thing, well, they didn't think the companies would permit not giving the CEOs a decent a package out. Excuse me, we're bailing you out. We're calling the shots. I mean, this is like somebody saying, you know, I'm rescuing you from terminal cancer, but you get to decide, you know, what hospital, what nurse, what...
I think it's, you know, a better metaphor. I don't know if you... Did you see Golden or Blazing Saddles?
No, I did not.
Oh, well, in that movie, there's this moment where, I forget the actor's name, where he puts a gun to his head and he says, "Stop or I'll shoot." He's got a gun to his own head, right? And it's just a precious moment in the movie, but it's like, that's what's going on here. Ellen, you're on a lot of talk shows, and I know that, you know, I'm one of the few progressives, because the simple matter, I mean, there's 1,000 radio stations in the country that carry conservative programming and fewer than 100 that carry liberal programming. So you must be on a lot of conservative shows. I know you are. What are the conservatives that you're talking to, the talk show hosts, what are they saying about this stuff?
Well, it depends which talk show host. Some people, you know, the Scott Hennins of the world, although he's my dear friend, you know, thinks that we ought to really help out and get this legislation through. But most people, and you know, Scotty understands that there are a lot of people even in his audience that are not real happy about this, because most people are kind of outraged by the golden parachute.
Yeah.
And I think this is going to come back to haunt them.
We had John Berlow on earlier from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is, you know, one of the larger conservative think tanks in the United States. And he's saying there shouldn't be any bailout at all. You know, that should be the conservative position.
Well, that would be a conservative position. Conservatives
yeah.
are looking like socialists these days.
Yeah. Well, it was his comment. This is socialism. And I said, no, socialism is when you care for the people. This is caring for the billionaires. That's different. This is a whole brand new category. Ellen Ratter, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Stick around. We'll be back after the news.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, a new Rasmussen poll conducted yesterday finds that 44% of Americans oppose the Bush administration's $700 billion bailout the billionaires plan, up from 37% a day earlier. Only 25% support it. Interesting. Robert Carter's on the line with us. He is a distinguished senior fellow at the nonpartisan think tank Demos, where he is working on a new program addressing domestic and international financial markets, trade, and regulation. Cutter is the co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, and he has a new book out. It's absolutely extraordinary. Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis, and the Power of a Transformative President. Robert Cutner, welcome to the show.
Hey, I'm really glad to be here.
I'm really glad you are. By the way, I want to congratulate you for handing Sean Hannity his ass the other day.
That you know, that was one of the happiest moments I ever had on television.
That was quite impressive.
It's what you do with a schoolyard bully.
Yeah, and the FoxSounds.us has the clip. If anybody wants to know what it is that you and I are talking about, their slogan is "We watch Fox, so you don't have to." So you can go over to FoxSounds.us and check it out. You're writing this book about the transformational presidents and the transformational presidency. Tell us about that.
Well, here's a basic storyline. I mean, the economy is in such bad shape that the next president is going to have to be like Roosevelt, or the economy is going to fall in on him. And I took a big risk. I mean, I got this book into print by Labor Day on the assumption that the economy would keep collapsing on schedule and that Obama would be elected president. And lo and behold, I think I'm being vindicated. I think, you know, last week was a game changer in the sense that not only did all of the bad stuff that the Republicans have been doing for 30 years come home to roost in a way that very dramatically illustrates the failure of right-wing ideology, but Obama recovered his voice. I mean, I think he was thrown off of his game by Palin. I think they spent a few weeks doing this generic post-ideological, post-partisan stuff that doesn't move anybody. And he finally grasped the fact that if it's the Republican Party that's responsible for leading the economy down the drain, it's no time to be post-partisan. It's time to be.
He needs to run against the Republican Party.
Right. And, you know, that's what the election is about. Which party's philosophy can you trust to govern the country?
Right.
And I think McCain is
coming apart. It's just not credible that he's a born-again William Jennings Bryan, and he's trying to. I think the politics of the bailout are really interesting. There's such a backlash against it at the grassroots level that the Republicans are outdoing the Democrats to try to be born-again regulators, and you've got McCain talking about greed on Wall Street and fire the head of the SEC, to which Obama had a great comeback on November 4th. You can fire the whole lot of them.
But we're talking with Robert Kuttner. His new book, Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis and the Power of a Transformative Presidency. You point out in your book, and most Americans don't know this. I've been ranting about this on this program for 6 years. But you point out in your book that when Franklin Roosevelt was elected in 1932, in the depths of the Depression, he was elected, and he ran, basically, as a guy who would make Hillary Clinton look like a leftist. He ran on a campaign of a balanced budget. In fact, one of the first things he did in his first week as a president was actually cut funding for war veterans and widows. It was the parade. It was the people. It was we the people demanding change that caused him, like any good politician, to realize that's one hell of a parade going down the street. I need to get out in front of it and hoist my flag.
Well, exactly. I mean, this book originated with an interview that I did with Doris Kearns Goodwin on transformational progressive presidents. And I said, Doris, you ought to do a book on this. She said, no, you do it. And I'll suggest sources. I'll read your chapters. It's dedicated to Doris. And I looked very hard in the book at Lincoln, Roosevelt, and the Lyndon Johnson of the Civil Rights era.
Right.
And I found two things. One, great presidents are made by crises and they grow in office, but not every crisis produces a great president. Witness Hoover, witness Carter. It's something about the character of the person that makes a great president. And secondly, it requires a social movement. So without the abolitionists, Lincoln wouldn't have been Lincoln. Without the industrial labor movement, Roosevelt wouldn't have been Roosevelt. And, of course, without Martin Luther King, Johnson would not have been a transformative president on civil rights. And so we the people have to get our tushes in gear if we want Barack Obama to be a transformative president in reversing the Reagan counter-revolution.
Right. The work does not end on November 4th. The work begins on November 4th.
Right.
And apropos to that, because this is such an important point, and I love talking about how, you know, Lyndon Johnson was this basically was a right winger, you know, from Texas, a cracker and a.
But let me say, in Johnson's defense, he had been a New Dealer in his youth. He'd been the head of Roosevelt's National Youth Administration in Southwest Texas. And then in order to get elected in Texas and get along with the oil boys, he became kind of a moderate on race and a conservative on economics.
Sure.
But in his heart, the day John Kennedy was shot, he decided that his legacy was to redeem the promise of Lincoln. And that's what he set out to do. So, you know, you never know where you're going to find greatness.
Yeah, and that's one of the things about LBJ that, frankly, for me, had always been a mystery, was when, you know, because his history in the Senate was so different from his presidency. And when he became president, did he listen to the will of the people and change himself as a politician, or did he have an epiphany, or did he recover his old original voice? And you just said that it was the latter.
I think it was two out of those three that you just mentioned. I think he was a poor kid who was very much a New Dealer. And then he was a very opportunistic politician. And then when Kennedy was shot, he decided that his legacy was going to be redeeming civil rights. And he actually had been doing it throughout 1963. He'd been the head of John Kennedy's Committee on Economic Opportunity, Equal Employment Opportunity, rather. He'd been pushing the Kennedys to be gutsier on civil rights. And he's a very complicated man. And then, of course, he ruined it all with Vietnam. So the bet is that because of his character and because of his history, Obama could be that kind of great transformative president, but we're going to have to push him.
Yeah, I read his book, Stories of My Fathers.
Dreams.
Dreams of My Father. Thank you. And you really get the sense this is a deep and thoughtful guy who has gone through a lot and has seen life from 16 different directions. And really gets it about America in a way that, frankly, you know, growing up as a white kid in a white community, I didn't get. I didn't, you know, I mean, and I think, you know, somebody who grew up as a black kid in a black community wouldn't get either. I mean, he He really has, not just on the issues of race, by the way, as you know, right across the board, he has the potential for greatness, as you pointed out. We, however, have to be the social movement that is going to push him to that kind of greatness. Otherwise, he's just going to, I mean, he's already got Larry Summers in there with him, you know, and Bob Rubin, you know, the guys who are the architects of a lot of what has been this destruction that we're seeing right now. How specifically do we get on the ground to make, assuming that he becomes elected president, you know, which is still a big assumption, but nonetheless, assuming he becomes elected president, how do we get on the ground to make this happen?
Well, you have the labor movement for the first time in decades actually increasing its membership last year. Some of the more progressive movement labor unions got behind Obama early, like Unite Here and SEIU. You've got an incredible youth movement. I mean, if Obama succeeds the jinx of people who tell pollsters that they're going to vote for him, but they won't vote for him because he's African American, that's going to be because younger voters offset that jinx and they have cell phones and they don't get counted. So I think it's going to be youth movement, labor movement. You've got groups like Acorn organizing in communities, and what you get in this kind of an economic crisis is you get fertile soil for social movements. And social change in this country has historically occurred when you have a rendezvous of mass movements and a potentially great leader who then becomes radicalized in office. I mean, the amazing thing, and it's very atypical of presidents, but Lincoln and Roosevelt and Johnson, at least through the Civil Rights period, became more radical in office, and that's what Obama's going to have to
do. And I think you could say the same probably of Washington and Jefferson. It seems that it happens every 80 years.
Well,
every 80 years there's a deep economic recession like there was in the 1760s, followed by a revolution, essentially, a war, a terrible time, followed by a transformational president.
If there's no guarantee, that's the point. I mean, Hoover had 3 years plus of the Depression getting deeper and deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
And he wasn't transformational anything, so it's up to us.
No, he wasn't, and in fact, FDR brought him back into the fold, because Hoover was a very smart guy and a decent person. He didn't get it, you know? He didn't get it. Robert Kuttner, the book is is Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis and the Power of a Transformative Presidency. Robert, thank you for being with us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour. Okay, let's just get a couple of things right here. Newshounds.us is the website for the folks who watch Fox, so you don't have to. And a great site it is, and great people they are. Newshounds.us. And there's this Hannity has a bully boy meltdown. It's just a hoot. And by the way, tip of the hat and thanks to the folks in the chat room for catching that on my end. And Hank Paulson, his $600 million worth of stock in Goldman Sachs 2 years ago, as I noted, Forbes 2 years ago listed that. I'm still not sure exactly of the status of it, but it is either in a blind trust or and probably divested. In all probability, he divested it when he became the Treasury Secretary, which would have been a very smart move, you know, good time to sell your stock. So in any case, here we have the foxes watching the hen house. I mean, this is just the bottom line. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Philip in Boca Raton. Hey, Philip.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Let me tell you specifically what's wrong with the government plan, then give you the solution, what I think the solution is. First of all, the government plan is betting if they underwrite these toxic loans that eventually they'll sell it out. Well, it goes like this. I traded derivatives and subprime mortgages and so on. In fact, the original obligation has been cut up so many times that you have no idea what traces back to what. In fact, there was a case where Deutsche Bank owned these subprime mortgages, and they wanted to foreclose. The homeowners went to court, and the judge said, okay, produce the original note. And they couldn't. And the judge said, go away. And they never came back.
Right. In other words, meaning that the paper where these mortgages have been sold and then sold and bundled and bundled and bundled and sold and sold and sold, that paper is meaningless. It's worthless.
That's right. It's so diluted you cannot trace back the original obligation.
That's right. So this is the $1,000 trillion derivatives market. It's not all mortgages, obviously, but
of course the
derivatives market is much of the derivatives market is composed of this kind of thing.
I know it is. Plus other garbage.
That's on all kinds of stuff.
Indexes, it's derivatives,
yep.
Another nonsense. Now, let me give you what I think is the solution. First of all, their solution does not address the problem. The problems stem from the subprime mortgages against real estate. Now, if you assume, for example, that there are 10 million homes on the hook, if we as the people went to these homeowners and paid them something on the order of $30,000, that's about 12% of their face value. And in exchange for that, we take over their loans, we renegotiate the loans, we pay them $30,000 against the loans. We take a percent of the upside. The more we give them, the more percent of the upside. That upside is directly against the homeowner. We actually have an obligation.
Right. What you're describing is what Franklin Roosevelt did, you know.
That's right.
And in fact, because there was no Fannie and Freddie at that point in time, those homeowners with those notes that got converted to 15-year fixed mortgages at 3%, those homeowners actually, for the full 15 years of the mortgage or the life of the mortgage, maybe they were 30 years. I thought that they were one or the other. In any case, 30 years. For the full 30 years, those homeowners were paying to the federal government.
Yeah, in fact, but when they sell the home, we get, as the taxpayer, part of their appreciation.
We get the money back, yeah.
No, not only do we get the money back, we get part of the appreciation as a return on the capital we lent them. So we lent them 30, we take part of their upside.
Right. So, interesting.
Now, when you do this,
so the 30 is like the 30 is essentially that you're suggesting $30,000 to every subprime homeowner is
essentially
a no interest loan.
That's correct, and you get the upside on it. And then you have the actual note against the homeowner, not of the nonsense that the government is doing.
Right.
Now,
right.
If you do this, effectively what you've done is remove 10 million homes selling pressure on the market.
Right.
That stops the decline. Now,
that's
since the homeowner is the biggest asset in people's books, and it's the multiplier in the economy, you stop the downward pressure on the economy. Now, could you do this? In fact, you can do this. It has been done. And it's a reasonable plan. So instead of bailing out Wall Street cronies, which is crony capitalism, you bail out the source of the problem, which happens to be the homeowner.
Yeah.
When you do that, you put the floor under the economy.
But see, Philip, what you're talking about is what I've been preaching for 6 years. It's what Franklin Roosevelt did. It is bottom-up economics.
Trickle-down.
These guys are all into trickle-down. They all think that the solution to every problem is at the top, and because they're all thinking hierarchical, they're all thinking, you know, and you know, the joke is that they've reduced us to a nation of peons with all this trickle-down, and they're not going to change their philosophy. This administration is not going to do what you're talking about. But I think that, you know, what you've laid out is a great suggestion, and you know, just broadly speaking, we need to be looking at how to get the money into the hands one way or the other, whether it's, you know, with infrastructure projects so that people have a job so that they can pay their mortgage even if it jacks up to 12%, or whether it's taking over the mortgage and reducing the interest rate so that with the job that they have they can pay it. But we need to be looking at ways to rebuild and remaintain the middle class in the United States.
If the government does their program, essentially what will happen, you'll crash the dollar, you'll make the dollar worthless, and because people are so stretched, demand will collapse, and you'll set a depression in motion.
Well, that's what's going to come out of the $700 billion bailout.
I realize that.
Because that's what happened in 1931 when Herbert Hoover tried the exact same thing.
And
it doesn't work. Philip, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. I mean, this is just nuts. And it's what happened, by the way, in Japan in 1998 when the Japanese tried it. And they bailed out their banks. And it didn't work. It didn't work for them. It didn't work for us. It's not going to work this time either. What's the old joke? Insanity? The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, thinking you're going to get a different result. I mean, give me one instance, one example of any time. This is not what we did, by the way, with the SNLs. This is a whole completely different thing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Thank you. freedom that we're fighting for? Is it still our creed from shore to shore? After a soldier fights, should we read him his new rights? There's not that many to read anymore. Where's all the freedom that we're fighting for?
We'll get it back, don't you worry. We're sticking around here. We're working to restore democracy to this republic. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bernie Sanders is with us. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website. And Bernie, in 1931, Herbert Hoover bailed out the banks. It didn't work. They went bankrupt the next year. In 1998, the Japanese bailed out their banks. It didn't work. What's going on in Washington, D.C.
Well,
right now?
What's going on, which disturbs me very much, is that we are looking at a bailout of unbelievable proportions. It's $700 billion. It could be higher than that. It is an extraordinarily risky proposal. And this comes from an administration, which up to a couple of months ago was so incompetent or dishonest, by the way, that they were telling us that the fundamentals of the economy are strong. And then suddenly, last week, they say, oh, we made a little bit of a mistake. It appears that we're in the midst, we're on the verge of a major financial breakdown. Now, you got a very complicated issue here. I voted, when I was in the House, against Graham Bliley Leach's proposal, which did away with the walls that were that had been established in the Depression era to prevent another depression. And I have voted against all of these deregulatory efforts, which have allowed the concentration of ownership in industry after industry. But right now, to my mind, we are in the absurd position of seeing the middle class, people whose standard of living has precipitously declined since Bush has been president because of his very reckless policies, having to bail out Wall Street, where people made obscene amounts of money. And that, to me, just is absolutely unacceptable.
Yeah.
So I think the very first thing that we have got to talk about, you can argue to the cows come home what we should be doing. Honest people may disagree how quickly you have to act. And by the way, I should tell you that this makes me, it just reminds me a little bit of the rush to give Bush the authority to go to war in Iraq. It reminds me a little bit about the Patriot Act. But be that as it may, let's take Paulson and Bernanke at their word. And let's say that they do need $700 billion. And the very simple question is, who pays for that? Should every man, woman, and child in this country, people who are struggling at $30,000, $35,000 a year, have to pay $2,200 per person, family of four, almost $9,000? I don't think so. I think you have a situation today where under Bush, the wealthiest people have seen just a huge increase in their wealth and income. Tom, if you can believe it, it's an astounding fact. The top 400 individuals in this country since Bush has been president have seen a $670 billion increase in their wealth. And they think it is the middle class who should have to go forward on this bailout. So I think before we even get into all of the complicated details of what we have to do to reform the system, a stimulus package, all of the other aspects of what we must do, not moving rashly, and thinking this thing through, the first point that should be established is that it's not the middle class who are already hurting, bailing out the wealthiest people who have never had it so good. And we have, among other things, we have a petition on my website, sanders.senate.gov. We already have, we put it up yesterday. We have 6,300 signatures. And I would like to be able to give this to Mr. Paulson and let him know that the American people, if he is so concerned about it, he himself, by the way, you should know, in his last year, I believe, at Goldman Sachs, received a $38 million bonus in 2005.
He walked away from Goldman with $700 million in Goldman stock, and because of a provision in the IRS code that was put in there by Bush Sr., so that for his buddies, he was able, because Section 1043 of the Internal Revenue Code says if you are in the executive branch and you have to sell stock in your company to defer to avoid conflict of interest rules, you defer paying capital gains. So he sold $700 million that had a basis of around $200 million. He had almost a $400 million capital gain that he never paid tax on.
I mean, it is just incredible. And it's not just Paulson. It's not just Bernanke. It's a whole host of these guys who acted in the most greedy way possible. And they wrecked the economy. And now, because of their greed and their avarice, it is the middle class who is supposed to step up to the plate.
Bernie, what are the politics of this, Democrats and Republicans?
Well, here's what my concern is. You know, and I remember, you know, like it was yesterday, I'm kind of talking personally here. I remember when I was in the House and there was a lot of discussion about the war in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And I remember Dick Gephardt, who was a friend of mine, just working with the president in the effort to move us toward that war. And I just sensed that it was such a serious mistake at that time. What I just don't want to see, this is the political scenario that I fear very much. What I fear is that you're going to have a Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, George Bush bailout of Wall Street. You're going to have Mr. McCain saying, oh, not me. I'm not going to bail out these reckless Wall Street traders, not me. And the Democrats are going to be locked in with George Bush taking the heat for this, and the Republicans are going to laugh all the way to Election Day. That's my nightmare scenario.
This is the October surprise.
This could be the October surprise. So the Democrats are worried that, on one hand, if they don't act, they will be punished by Wall Street with declining markets and other economic problems. But if they do act, they're going to be lumped with Bush, and McCain and Karl Rove are going to laugh all the way to Election Day. Now, what is the answer? I mean, for a simple answer to my mind would simply be to put an amendment, which I'm going to try my hardest to get onto the floor when this thing arises, and say, fine, Mr. Paulson, you want this $700 billion? That's good. Here's an amendment which says your friends are going to pay for this, not my constituents. And if the Republicans vote against it, well, that tells us that they want the middle class to pay for it. I think that's one way to clear the air.
But in a way, that's sort of like the Democrats making the statements that they made with the FISA bill, you know, where they tried to water it down, they tried to dilute it, but, you know, they were feeble efforts and they were not remembered, frankly.
Right. Well, I think the point being that nobody who is not in the top 1% should be paying for this bailout will be remembered. That's a pretty clear statement.
Yeah.
So that's what I hope.
So people should go over to sanders.senate.gov and sign your petition.
So what we are talking about, let me just review some of the proposals. And
Bernie, apparently we've crashed your website. The folks in our chat room say that they can't get on there.
Oh, Jesus.
It might just be that so many people are trying to get in right now.
Yeah, that could be. But I want to review just four proposals that we think should take place right now. Number one, most importantly, it should not be the middle class who are paying for this. We are proposing a surtax on people who are couples who make at least $1 million a year, 10% surtax on their income. And that would probably cover almost all the money that you would need, because they don't need $700 billion all at once. It would bring in about $300 billion. So this would be among the top, I don't know, 0.3%, 0.4% of 1%. Number two, we want to ensure that assets purchased from banks, this is very important, are realistically discounted so companies are not rewarded for their risky behavior. And we want to require that taxpayers receive equity stakes in the bailed out companies. All right. Yeah. So that's terribly important. Also, obviously, in the midst of all this, we have to understand why we got into it. As I said earlier, in 1999, I voted against Graham Leach Bliley, which deregulated financial services. We've got to bring back sensible regulation. Tom, you may have noticed yesterday that oil went off the wall.
Yeah.
That yesterday's activity in terms of oil should put an end to any of the debate about whether speculation is a significant factor.
It didn't go up when the hurricane happened.
That's right. But here's the point. What does yesterday's huge increase in oil prices have to do with supply and demand?
Yeah, nothing. It has to do with money moving around.
Exactly. That's correct. And the other point that very few people are talking about is this whole concept, we are where we are today because of the too big to fail doctrine. It seems to me if an institution is too big to fail, it is too big to exist. And what we have got to do, whether it's the Sherman Antitrust or whatever, we have got to say that it makes no economic sense for the entire economy to be dependent upon maintaining these huge, huge, huge institutions, which, if they fail, taxpayers are going to have to pick up the cost. So let's start breaking them up right now. It's ironic that in the midst of this crisis, Bank of America incorporates Countrywide and Merrill Lynch. Well, you know what? If next year Bank of America is going under, they're going to have to be bailed out because they are also very much too big to fail. So there's a lot that has to be done. But I think the major argument that should be made now, in midst of all of the analysis that's taking place, all of the ideas that people have as to how we can improve the economy, the central point right now is if Bush and his friends think they need $700 billion, fine. Go to their wealthy friends who have made out like bandits because of their reckless policies and get the money from them, not from the middle class.
Right. Amen.
All right. I'm going to run because we'll have a vote in a minute. But Tom,
okay.
Thanks very much.
Sure. Sanders.Senate.gov, the website. Thank you, Bernie. And by the way, speaking of the banks, Mitsubishi UFJ, Mitsubishi Bank is buying 10 to 20% in Morgan Stanley. They hold $1.15 trillion in deposits. They spent $10 billion in August to buy Union Bancal Corporation, the Bank of California.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Sounds like a good plan. We just have to get the free world together 9.5 minutes before the hour. You know, every week we try to identify for you and for folks who might be listening who are business people who are thinking, you know, maybe progressive radio would be a good way to reach folks. How, you know, some success stories of advertisers on our various affiliates. And today Rosemary Roberts is with us. She's the Communications and Marketing Director for Horowitz, Horowitz & Associates, a law firm in Chicago. Horowitz Law, HORWITZLAW.com is the website. And Rosemary, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
And thanks so much for advertising on our Chicago affiliate, WCPT, AM 820. The format for this is basically we give you a minute to pitch your product, you know, tell us about your product and service, and a minute to talk about what kind of success you've had advertising on you know, progressive talk radio. So what is Horowitz and Horowitz Associates?
Horowitz, Horowitz and Associates is a law firm. They are a third-generation personal injury law firm committed to legal advocacy on behalf of individuals injured through no fault of their own. We have offices in both Chicago and Joliet, and, of course, practice throughout mostly northern Illinois. The Horowitz firm represents clients within the traditional areas of practice that most people think of with personal injury, workers' compensation, private property injuries, defective consumer products. We have some outstanding attorneys working on auto rollover and roof crush cases and other auto defective cases. And specifically, we also have a very aggressive department that is representing clients and their families, people who have been injured through nursing home abuse and neglect.
Hmm.
we yeah. are making.
I know that there's a lot of that, coming
huge.
To light right now. It's just huge.
It
terrible.
So
if anybody in the Chicago area thinks that any of these areas are things where they have been essentially the victim of malfeasance, Horwitz Law, HorwitzLaw.com, the website. And Rosemary Roberts, the communications and marketing director, how has it worked advertising on WCPT AM 820?
Well, it works great. I'll tell you what, progressive radio really fits my personality as a communications director because I'm really not good at fluff. I don't do junk mail. You know, I hate getting it, so I can't write it. I like hitting things really straight up, and that is an incredible audience for me and for what we do because progressive listeners are a captive audience. You've got their attention. They're engaged. They're actually listening. They're participating in the discussion by calling in. There's a degree of educational and intelligence there that you just don't often get with some of the other radio platforms that maybe have a younger age group that are more interested in where Friday night's party is going to be. With Progressive, you get engaged people who have assets that they need to protect, family members they need to protect. So they're participating, and they're there on Progressive Radio because they want information that is beneficial to them, beneficial to their families. And most of all, they have an incredibly strong interest in truth. They're going to reject fluff. So what I love about Progressive Radio is it gives people an opportunity to market their services and their company in a straight-up way.
Yep. Rosemary, we have to wrap it up, but thank you. Thank you so much for advertising on Progressive Talk Radio on WCPT.
Great.
And thanks for the great work that you and the attorneys are doing at Horwitz Law, horwitzlaw.com.
Thanks.
Good talking with you today. 54 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. I just want to highlight what Bernie Sanders said in the last hour. This really concerns me, and I don't want to let the show today slide by without really focusing on this. We're going to try and get this audio on our website and get it over on the Air America website and spread it around the web, that this could be the October surprise. The Bush administration sets this thing up. And frankly, just like immigration reform, this is what it reminds me of. And the Democrats go, hey, that's a pretty good idea. We're not all that happy about it, but, you know, we'll go along with this because you've stampeded us into it. And the Republicans say, oh, wait a minute. We're not going to go along with that. And most of Americans don't want to go along with it. And in fact, that's what the polls are showing right now, is that fewer than a quarter of Americans are in favor of bailing out the billionaires and the banks. And almost half of all Americans actively oppose it. And yet we may end up with a Reid, Pelosi, Bush piece of legislation. And that is going to hurt Barack Obama's presidency, his chance to gain a presidency. That could, as Bernie said, that could be the thing that hands John McCain the presidency. Because McCain is running around campaigning against this thing. He's arguing that incorrectly. He's lying, saying that Obama has no plan for the economy. Obama laid out a detailed six-point plan to deal with the economic crisis that these guys are talking about, and did so several days ago. But nonetheless, if McCain ends up being the champion of opposing this bailout, and Obama kind of goes down the middle, and the Democrats pass it, because keep in mind, who controls the House and Senate right now? The Democrats. This is going to be like a rock hung around the neck of Barack Obama as they toss him into the water. I mean, this is just going to be a disaster. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, Alex Epstein, analyst of the Ayn Rand Institute, and I will debate capitalism versus democracy, round 3, the morality of democracy. Should be fun. Plus, I'll challenge Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com, about the economy. Is it really the derivative, stupid? We'll see what Terry has to say. Of course, the best of the rest of the news right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Get over to Sanders.Senate.gov and sign the petition. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.